Thank you very much, Kate. That was wonderful. In fact, you said some things that you didn't tell me before, so I couldn't use them.
Oh, sorry about that. It was all in your book. It wouldn't have been any use for
this. I'm sure there are lots of... I'm sure there will be a lot of people who would like to ask Kate a question.
You wrote a very powerful book, Why I Am Not a Christian. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned that you were bitten, as you put it, by religion in the 50s.
Mm.
Were you, do you think, in that case, sort of unconsciously reacting against your father? Because he was a very persuasive and immensely passionate book, very cogent and tremendously sincere. It had a tremendous effect upon me when I read it in the early 60s. Mm. I think what time it was first published.
Oh, long ago, yes. I think before I was born he wrote that. I think if you read it as a Christian, he never dealt seriously with serious Christianity. He just dealt with its excrescences. Which are terrible, and he's quite, everything that he said about the excrescences of Christianity was fair, but I don't think he ever really got to the heart of it. I still don't think that, although I'm not really a Christian myself anymore. I don't know, does that help?
Well, I was wondering if you thought that you might yourself have actually overreacted against it, because Yes, I did.
Because, in spite of all their liberal theories and bringing up children freely and all that, I grew up with an enormous sense of guilt, just enormous, that I was vile and hopeless and, I would never be any good to anybody. And when I became a Christian, it was a great relief to me, because then I found out that, everybody's like that, and, you're not really expected to be good all by yourself. So yes, it was, in a sense, it was a reaction to what I'd been brought up with, yes. Yeah.
Wouldn't you have said that though not a Christian, an extremely religious person?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think so.
You expected tremendous high standards of morality, or personal morality. Though, as you might say, I'm sure he was often not easy in his human relations. He was exceedingly anxious to forward human behavior through what would be called morality, if not religion.
Yeah, but I think, there's morality and religion, they're not always the same thing at all, because lots of us who are not religious can still have morals and ethics, but they're not based on religion. I think he was, he had a sense of the mystery of the universe, which was religious.
Yes.
And he had very high standards of behavior, which he learned from his grandmother, I think, who was religious.
Yes.
But I think his morality was not religious. It was separate from his sense of the awe of the universe. That's what I think.
Can I just ask, could you go back a little to this pool? And did your father invent any games he would play? I don't mean sport, but a sort of game by which you would learn something. Were there any such things?
I don't think there were learning games. He used to, he played with us quite a lot, but that was not part of learning. The learning was fairly straightforward.
So what was the play? Oh,
well, he would tell jokes, and we would be out sort of running around and playing tag and things like that, and he would watch. Mostly, I think he just kind of watched ordinary children's games. But we didn't really learn by games very much, I don't think.
I'd like to ask a question about school too, because going back to my first job in the 1930s, I was junior reporter on a number of local newspapers in the outskirts of London, one of which was Burnt Hill Gazette. And in Burnt Hill at that time, there was a place called the Watling Estate, where it was a working class estate. It was an experimental place. And I reported a meeting of the local debating society when your mother arrived to give a talk about the school, about education at Creakham Hill, about which there are some marvellous stories in Caroline's splendid biography. And Dora Russell, who must have been running the school herself then, I think, because it was towards, must have been about 1935.
Yes, she would have been, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Expected these working men to be terribly excited to hear about this free school. And it gave me the impression, and she was shocked, her mother, that they were so shocked. By what she told them about the school and the way it was run. And I had the impression from the talk, although I can't remember any details of it anymore, that, you know, it would have made Neil and Summerhill look like a Eden.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
It was as free as it could be. And I was surprised to hear that the teaching was so good from what you said today. But perhaps I've got wrong memories of what she said.
Well, she was always much more, much freer about it than my father, but I think even when she was running it, it was never as free as Neil's, because, well, Neil was more a therapist than a school teacher. And his school was a healing environment for troubled children. And if they wanted to go to class, they did, and if they didn't, they didn't. We didn't have to go to class either, but it was taken for granted that you would and that it would be interesting, and that, you know, there wasn't much to do if you didn't. That's where, you know, I taught for a while in various schools in America, and I used to think, you know, oh dear, you know, my father's idea was if people don't want to go to class, they don't have to. But if you've got a school of several hundred children, what do you do with the ones who don't want to go? They just rack it up and down the halls, and you can't run a school that way. Unless it's a very small and privileged environment. And it never would have worked for just general state schools. It just couldn't. But you know, when my mother was running it, the learning part was less, certainly. But it was always there, yeah. You know. But that wouldn't be what she would talk about, because, you know, I mean, you take it for granted that a school is for learning, but what you want to tell people is what's different about it.
Can I ask whether either you or Caroline Moorhead have read Gilbert Cannon's description of Russell in his book Bugs and Peacocks?
No.
I have, but I don't remember it. Yes, I have.
I don't think I have.
Did you
find
very closely his appearance, his tranquility?
Yes,
my movements.
Yes.
So on.
It was, in fact, it's fiction, isn't it? He's made out.
It's fiction, but
yes.
Gilbert worked with Bertrand
yes.
in the pacifist.
You never knew him, perhaps?
No. Mm. No.
So, yeah. I wondered how good a picture it was of him.
I don't know. You're not having read it.
And what about Caroline Moorhead, who's written what a book on him? Was it a good picture of him or not?
It's awful to say. I can't really enough remember that description. I mean, so many people wrote about him, either as fiction or describing him. I mean, doing research for him, it was amazing how many people and put him into their books and turned him into characters.
Mm-hmm.
So they rather run into my mind.
They would, yes. That he'd been in an awful lot of books by this time.
Perhaps I could ask you a question. You said at the beginning that your father had been turned into a sort of industry.
Yes.
What is it like for you when people like myself keep approaching you and asking and asking you terrible questions about the past? It's been happening to you, after all your life.
Well, yes, it has. I think, From very early on, my brother and I were both aware that we had a great man for a father, and we were very proud of it, but it didn't really affect us. I mean, the outside didn't impinge on us a great deal until much later. I must say that for ages and ages, I used to sort of keep quiet about it out of a kind of inverted pride. I didn't want people to think I was boasting about that. And then after I got married and I had another name, it was easy to keep quiet about it. I don't really mind it anymore. It's long ago now.
What is your impression that he enjoyed having rows? I mean, so you seem to have rows with so many people. I was reading about him when he was in Wales after the death of your mother, and the Kirstlers were in Wales.
Oh no, that was Peter's row, that wasn't his.
It was her row.
It was her row, yes, it was entirely. Now, I don't think he really ever enjoyed it. If it was a matter of principle, yes, he would stand up and have any, knockdown, drag out, verbal fight. But I don't think he enjoyed rows. That was hers. She was a, by that time, she did enjoy rows, I think.
Had a new relationship with a woman.
I mean,
did that affect you as a girl?
No, it didn't. Well, most of them I didn't really know about anyway. When he took up with my stepmother, Peter, that was his third wife, she was very nice to me, and I thought she was wonderful. I liked her a lot better than my mother for ages. So other than that, I didn't really know a lot about them, no.
Do you think there were similarities between your mother and your father's other wives?
It's a little hard to put your finger on it, but I think if you look at their photographs, there was a similar type, just physically. And I've been reading recently this early book of his letters from his early years, in which he describes his first wife when he first knew her and how natural and energetic and bubbling she was, like a sort of natural spring. And he said the same sort of things about my mother. So yes, there was that. And probably he felt the same about my stepmother. I think when it came to the last one, I think Edith was a quite different proposition and much more soothing.
He did write in his autobiography that it was not his nature to be in love with any woman for more than 9 years.
Yes, well, I think that's stretching it.
Yes, I think you mentioned very briefly about his childhood, but you said that he took a very austere childhood. I find it rather surprising if you were living in Pembroke Lodge in Richmond Park there.
Yes. Well, yes, I think he says so himself, that he really he liked Pembroke Lodge a whole lot. Yeah. And there were fairly a lot of wild gardens around there, and huge tall trees that he used to climb up. You know, I don't think his childhood was really quite as miserable as he paints it in his autobiography and in the things he used to say about it. He was probably a bit lonely, but I think Pembroke Lodge was a great place for him to be. It was austere in the sense that his grandmother was austere. It was never considered proper for children to have fruit, for instance. Fruit was supposed to be bad for them. And when somebody gave him a box of chocolates once, he was supposed to hand it round to all the grown-ups, and he was allowed to have one on Sundays. I mean, in that sort of way, it was austere. And he had to get up and practice the piano before breakfast and things like that. It was a privileged environment, but it wasn't exactly a comfortable one.
Yes.
Please, I can add your lottery for a question. You were, of course, a small child. When you were in California during the beginning of the Phoney War, and I was there, by the way, and I know that your father saw a great deal of the Krishnamurti and Aldous Huxley. How did they converge, or the opposite, in their pacifist and non-pacifist views?
Yes, well, I can remember going and visiting the Huxleys, but I... Oh, house was all covered in bougainvillea, and then there was a swimming pool. But, I was not a part of the conversations. Didn't they? Oh. Well, all right. I remember being there in a bathing suit because I scraped my leg on the bumper of a car. So there must have been some reason to be there in a bathing suit. Yes, maybe that was all. But I don't know. It was really difficult for my father to give up his pacifism. He just decided that Hitler was worse than war. I think many people thought so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that Mr. Barnes came to the rescue. But I know when I first met your father, he'd asked him over. I knew your brother.
Yeah.
And we looked for somewhere for him to live somewhere near here. I think it was in Sloane Square somewhere. And he could hardly speak about Mr. Barnes, so passionately did he feel against Mr. Barnes and let him down somewhere. I wonder.
Well, he did, yes. Oh, it was awful. Because, Mr. Barnes came to the rescue and gave him a 5-year contract to teach at this place outside Philadelphia. But then everybody told him before he went there, you must get him to sign the contract because he always turns against people before too long. And sure enough, he did, you see. So then there he was in the soup again with no job and no money. And that's when he wrote the History of Western Philosophy. And Simon and Schuster gave him a big advance so that he didn't starve.
Did Mr. Barnes give a reason for
it? Well, it was ostensibly on account of my stepmother sitting and clacking her knitting needles in the back of the lecture hall and disturbing the students. And, I don't know. I didn't really want to know about it by that time. I was away, and thank God I was away. I didn't want to know about it. But I think it was largely a quarrel with my stepmother.
Is there any other question?
What do you attribute this guilt feeling that you mentioned you had when you were a child?
Well, that I still can't tell you. I don't know. And it was just a hopeless feeling of Well, the standards were always beyond what I could measure up to, always. And
well, because you expected to be so good, but
you thought
that you weren't. And if you've been brought up in a Christian background with the doctrine of original sin, you think you might paradoxically have actually had felt less guilt, do you think?
Well, that's very hypothetical. But you see, we were expected, you know, if you read what they wrote at the time, they thought that if they brought up children in this free and liberated way, these children would turn out to be wonderful heroes and heroines and would go out and reform the world. And I never wanted to do that. Yes.
And in the letters that he wrote to leaders like Stalin and Eisenhower, he showed a sort of naive expectancy of rationality appealing about political interest.
Yeah.
And goodness.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed, Kate. Most enjoyable talk.
Yeah. I don't think so. And it wasn't Eisenhower either, it was Kennedy. Well, he may have written.
Well, on behalf of all of us, also thank Caroline, who will have a second lovely presentation.
It wasn't so bad, Caroline.